talk to that won't give you answers you already have. Maybe we can play some tactics games sometime. Might be useful to you to practice against someone you can't read as easily.
Asphodel nodded.
Yes.
Well, the hook is in her. We'll see if I can reel her in later.
I have to hurry for now. I think I have another test to take. But we should talk again soon.
Asphodel tilted her head quizzically.
Very well.
Velis finished changing, belted on her sword and knife, and put on her backpack to prepare for travel.
Any ideas where I'm going to be headed?
Telling you would be cheating,
Asphodel said, giving the slightest smile.
Right. Cheating. Wouldn't want to do that.
No.
Velis just shook her head.
I'm really going to have to keep an eye on this one.
Velis arrived at the briefing room a few minutes early and stood outside as patiently as she could.
I wasn't expecting them to send us out of the city so soon. Am I going to be set up with a squad? If so, wouldn't it logically be Talion and Landon?
They eliminated more than three people. We can't be evenly distributed into squads of three now. I wonder if they're going to break us up into different-sized groups for different tasks.
Second Lieutenant Banks emerged from the briefing room a few moments later, wearing a dour expression.
You're early.
She slammed the door shut behind her. Startled by the lieutenant's attitude, Velis still managed to raise a hand in a weak salute.
At ease. Your next test is another simulation. Assume that you are just about to walk into the briefing room for an assignment, just like you were, but that you hear something unusual inside.
Banks snapped her fingers, and Velis felt a wave of sound sorcery pass her. She barely resisted the urge to interact with it during the instant of contact.
Stop right there!
The voice was unmistakably Landon's, and it was coming from inside the room.
Drop your weapon!
Remember, this is a simulation, the second lieutenant assured her. Dominion of Protection, form a layer of armor around applicant Velis.
Banks pressed a hand against Velis's shoulder, and the former Queen's Guard felt the familiar sensation of a suit of incorporeal armor wrapping around her. She knew from experience that the spell would dampen, but not completely absorb any attacks that struck her, at least until the armor was destroyed.
The people inside will be shielded as well?
Velis asked. The second lieutenant nodded, and Velis heard the clash of steel on steel.
You may begin.
Velis snapped into focus, immediately playing into the simulation.
Sir, I believe I hear combat in the briefing room.
Banks frowned, which Velis took as a sign that she wasn't expecting to be included in the simulation.
Go see what it is. I'll seek out help.
Yes, sir.
Velis spun around, drawing her sword and rushing to the door. She heard a thump inside, followed by a groan. She grabbed the door handle and turned it, immediately taking a defensive stance while she scanned the room. A black, cloaked figure was standing over Landon, who was lying face upward on the floor, his twin swords both lying out of his reach. He had visible cuts, real or fake, on both of his arms, and his uniform was cut over his chest, but she couldn't see any injury to his torso from the current angle. The figure that loomed above him was dressed in all black, wearing a white neutral mask and a voluminous black cloak. The gender of the figure was indeterminate, but he or she was carrying a single longsword, paladin standard issue, and looked to be about ready to plunge it into Landon's chest.
A stereotypical assassin. Not a thing like the reality, but I get the point.
Stop! Velis shouted, drawing the figure's attention.
I've already called for help. This place will be swarming with paladins in minutes. Landon there is a low-value target. He's just a cadet. Killing him will accomplish nothing for you. Surrender now, and we will give you a chance to explain yourself.
Somehow, in spite of the mask, she thought she could see the assassin's eyes narrowing in scrutiny. Then he turned and ran, throwing something at the floor behind him as he moved. Landon was roughly in the center of the room. Velis judged that the other door, which led deeper into the building, was about 5 meters away from the assassin. A glance at the floor quickly identified what the assassin had thrown. Caltrops, designed to slow down pursuit. With motion sorcery, she normally could have quickly covered the distance between them, but the caltrops would make that trickier. If she jumped, and then used a burst of motion to push herself across the room...
But maybe I'm thinking about this the wrong way... Maybe catching the assassin isn't the most important part of this test.
She rushed to Landon's side, throwing off her backpack, eyes following the assassin while he rushed into the next room.
"What are you doing, Val? Get after him!"
Landon coughed, clutching at his chest. It was a fake wound. She could see that clearly now that she was up close, but he was putting up a good performance.
"That's not my priority right now. I've already raised the alarm. He's not getting away. Now how do you feel?"
She examined the injuries, noting something that looked sickly greenish mixed with his blood.
"Oh, I feel like I just got sliced open a few times. Should be fairly evident, yeah?"
"Don't smart talk me. Can you raise your right arm?"
His arm shuddered slightly, but didn't move.
"Resh. Okay."
She opened her backpack, swiftly finding her medical kit.
"How much pain would you say you're in?"
"Quite a lot, actually. More than these little cuts should be."
"Listen, Val, he got the drop on me.
I don't need excuses. I need to diagnose you. Remain calm and keep your breathing stable." Landon frowned.
"All right."
"Are you feeling any tingling in your extremities?"
"Yeah, a little now that you mention it. And a buzzing in my left ear."
Velis let out a curse, grabbing a coil of rope from her bag. It was the best thing she could think of.
"Bite down on this."
He blinked, but complied when she shoved the coil in his mouth.
"This is going to hurt. A lot."
She retrieved an empty flask from the medical kit, as well as two vials, and poured in some of each vial. 3/4 adenis root extract, 1/4 vespis leaf. Giving the ingredients out loud for the benefit of whatever judges were obviously watching the exchange. It was the specific antidote to Scythus viper venom, which was the poison his symptoms seemed to indicate he was suffering from. Normally his eyes would also be dilated, but she expected that they didn't go to the extreme of faking that for the test. Once the liquid was mixed, she poured it onto the chest wound. It sizzled on contact, causing Velis's eyes to widen briefly. That was supposed to happen if it was real poison. She hadn't expected a reaction to occur.
Whoever faked the alchemical portion of this took it very seriously. I wonder if I was supposed to test his blood for the poison somehow. But I don't have a way to do that quickly. I suppose if it's always the same test regardless of who's participating, they might have put some real venom on his uniform in case a knowledge sorcerer decided to test it.
"It should be working," she said. Landon gritted his teeth against the rope, twitching on the floor and moaning slightly. His acting was pretty good, considering he probably wasn't in any actual discomfort. Hopefully. Next, she mixed another batch of the antidote, pouring it on his other two wounds. It reacted similarly. She had worried briefly that he might have been exposed to multiple poisons, but the attacker only had a single visible weapon, and mixing poisons on a single blade was rare.
"Are you feeling any better?"
Velis asked. Landon weakly shook his head.
"Fair enough. Probably will take you a few hours to feel any better. If you said you were, I'd think you were lying to get me to chase the assassin."
She grinned. Landon spat out the rope.
"You should go after him now, regardless."
She shook her head.
"Nope. He could loop back around to finish the job. My work isn't finished until you're on your feet."
He moved a hand to try to push himself up, and she grabbed his wrist.
"Don't even think about it. You need a few hours at a minimum, and you're still bleeding, even if the poison is most likely neutralized." "You still feeling the tingling in your hands?"
Landon shook his head.
"No."
"All right, let's get you cleaned up."
She tore the cut in his uniform wider, distributing a little bit more of the antivenom across the surface of his skin, and then retrieved a roll of bandages from her medical kit and began to wrap his chest.
"Just relax. We're going to get you better."
"Sorry, Val. I messed up."
He coughed, wincing afterward.
"Nonsense. I assume he cut you before you even saw him?"
Landon nodded weakly. He was sweating profusely, which was a little odd given that he probably hadn't actually been poisoned.
"Yeah. Came here for my mission briefing, but no one was here. Not anyone I could see, anyway. Heard something and turned around. The guy had sliced my left arm open before I could draw. Tried to talk him down, but I got weaker and weaker. Had to drop my left sword, then he found an opening."
"Did you get a good look at him?"
Landon shook his head.
"No. Did you see anything?"
"Might be part of the test."
"He's carrying a paladin-issue sword, so he could be one of us," she thought back, finishing the wrapping on his chest and beginning to bandage his arms.
"His garb was unusual. Concealed his appearance, sure, but wearing a cloak like that is impractical. He looked more like a caricature than a real assassin. Not to say he wasn't dangerous, of course. Throwing those caltrops means he was pretty well prepared. You've got good eyes and reflexes. If he got the drop on you, he's probably a sight or shadow sorcerer.
You're just saying that to make me feel better.
Landon gave a brief grin, but it faltered when she tightened the bandages around his left arm.
Don't take these off. If the tingling returns, inform me immediately. Are you injured anywhere else?
He frowned.
Well, it's a little embarrassing, but...
Nothing I haven't seen before, I assure you.
She folded her arms. Just treat me like a doctor.
Well, he hit me in the leg. Just below my...
Left leg or right leg?
Right,
he said, grimacing. She leaned over, finding a slit in his pants that had been concealed by his position, cursing. She removed a pair of scissors from her pack, methodically snipping off the pant leg at just above the point of the cut. There was a thin line across his skin. Just a graze. She mixed more of the antidote.
This one's not too bad, but this is still going to sting. Bite the rope.
She offered the rope back to him, and he grudgingly bit down. She was washing the wound when the door behind her burst open. Three armed and armored paladins, Banks in the lead, swarmed into the room.
Jaldin, report!
Banks ordered. Velis continued washing the wound, not pausing to salute.
A would-be assassin attacked Landon moments ago. He is carrying a paladin-issue longsword laced with Scythus viper venom. He is wearing a mask and a heavy cloak, and potentially carrying other weapons concealed within. He threw caltrops on the other side of the room to slow pursuit. Cadet Landon is poisoned and injured. He fought bravely, but the assassin had the element of surprise. Given that Landon did not immediately see anyone in the briefing room, the assassin may be a sight or shadow sorcerer, and whoever was supposed to be briefing Landon may be injured as well.
Good work, Cadet.
She gestured to the other two paladins with her.
Peters, Valorin, pursue the assassin. I'll see if I can locate whoever was supposed to give the briefing.
The two paladins swiftly moved past Landon and Velis. She watched them carefully, just in case one of them was going to make any sudden actions that would indicate betrayal. When the two other paladins had made it to the other side of the room, one of them opened the door.
And that concludes the test,
Banks said.
Cadet Jaldin, Cadet Landon, you may return to your quarters.
Landon grinned and raised an arm to wipe off his forehead, his pained expression fading immediately.
Nice work there, Vel. Thanks for saving me.
She reached down and offered him a hand to help him stand, which he accepted.
Sure. Sorry about your pants, though.
He shrugged.
Hey, if I'm going to have my pants cut off, you're the first person I'd want to do it.
Charmer.
She grinned, turning back to Second Lieutenant Banks.
How'd I do?
The second lieutenant's expression was neutral.
You'll find out when everyone else's tests are completed. Dismissed!
She's no fun at all.
Velis saluted, and Landon quickly mirrored the gesture.
Come on, let's get you some new pants.
Chapter 11 Lydia 3 Hints of a Broader Game. Lydia stared at her pieces on the board, inching a hand toward one of the mounted knights on the right side. Across the table, Nakane sat with her hands folded in her lap, her expression neutral.
I probably should have asked Aladir for advice before letting Nakane convince me to play. I expected her to go easy on a beginner. I apparently expected wrong.
Her deliberations were interrupted by the sound of one of the house guards approaching. He bowed to Nakane, who gestured for the man to speak.
"Milady, there are visitors at the gate. They claim to be acquaintances of Miss Hastings."
Nakane turned her head toward Lydia, quirking an eyebrow.
"Expecting visitors, Lydia?"
She nodded, though she couldn't keep her expression completely neutral.
"Yes, but not so soon. I believe those visitors will be the Thorngard contacts I mentioned." "Ah, of course. Eldon, please bring them in. I will be quite interested to meet Lydia's friends."
Nakane turned back toward Lydia as the guard moved to comply.
"But don't think this gets you out of our match."
"Of course not." The sorceress pushed up her glasses.
"I was just warming up."
Nakane cracked a grin, a rare sight in Lydia's experience. Perhaps she had smiled more when her brother was alive, but Lydia did not know the young woman well enough to judge. Lydia stood up from the table and stretched.
straightening out her tunic. Nakane stood as well, running fingers through her hair and then turning her head toward the sound of approaching footsteps. Jonin was better dressed than usual, indicating an unusual level of awareness of social conventions on his part. His red tunic matched one of the colors of House Theus, indicating a degree of respect and solidarity. He wore gray trousers with knee-high black boots, which Lydia noted to be common among higher-class citizens this year. He was cleanly shaven for what was, as far as Lydia could guess, probably the first time ever. His brown hair also looked to have been trimmed short and slicked back.
Not bad, Jonin. You could probably pass for a Thorngard, which is probably your intention.
Seeing his companion lent a degree of context to his unusually pristine appearance. Her indigo eyes, completely lacking sclera, were just as striking as Lydia remembered from their days in Orlan's courts. She had rarely encountered the so-called goddess Vorain, but the woman was unmistakable in spite of her own change in garb. Gone were the flowing, rune-etched robes of office, replaced by a simple Thorngard tabard over a male hauberk. The armor covered to just below her waist and was cinched by a belt carrying a long, fin-bladed dueling sword. Her trousers and boots were a perfect match for Jonin's.
"My Lady Nakane," Jonin offered, stopping several feet away and bowing at the waist. "It is my utmost pleasure to meet you. I am Jonin Kestrian, scribe to the Thorngard, and this is my companion
Voriana, my lady,"
the Rethri woman cut in, bowing as well.
"Also with the Thorngard. Pleasure."
"Voriana? Really? That's the best they could come up with?"
"You are both welcome guests in my home, Thorngards. What brings you here?"
Nakane looked at Vorain, openly appraising the young woman. If she had any knowledge of Vorain's other identity, she didn't betray it in her expression, just a degree of curiosity and interest. Lydia took the moment to shoot Jonin a quizzical look, which he replied to with an exaggerated wink.
"Well, Jonin heard from your Lydia,"
Vorain pointed helpfully at the sorceress,
"that you'd be needing a couple extra sets of hands. I've got me some time to kill, being on leave and all, and lost a bet to this bastard besides. So, here we are."
"Here you are indeed."
Nakane turned her gaze toward Jonin.
"Lydia spoke quite kindly of you, but she did not indicate that you were a simple scribe. I was under the impression she had contacted you to see if the Thorngard could provide me with additional protection, given the absence of a response from her own organization."
Jonin nodded. "Yes, that's right. Lydia and I are old friends, you see. We go way back."
8 months and change,"
Lydia noted.
"And?"
Nakane prompted. Jonin shrugged a shoulder. "And here we are. Oh, if you're worried that we're not a sufficient force, don't be. Voriana here is one of our best. And if you need to be defended against any sort of paperwork, I'm your man."
"Intriguing. And what sort of paperwork defense do you provide?"
"Well," Jonin lifted his right hand, opening his palm, "I find it best to be thorough." A sphere of orange flame flickered to life in his hand. Even from a distance, Lydia could feel the heat emanating from the orb, which meant something important.
"That's real fire. That's new. Either that or he just never shared the talent with me before. Strange that he'd choose this moment to demonstrate the skill, if he was deliberately hiding it in the past, however. What would that imply?"
"Ah, a fire sorcerer. Very well. I suppose you have an applicable skill after all."
Nakane nodded appreciatively.
"You can dismiss that now."
Jonin closed his hand, the flame disappearing as he made the gesture.
"I've heard you're quite the talented sorceress yourself, Miss Theus. Perhaps we could trade some tricks while I'm here."
"I doubt that. Your assassin's sorcery leaves a poor taste in my mouth."
She hesitated for a moment, her eyes narrowing, and then added,
"But I won't discount the idea entirely."
"Excellent," Jonin said. "And if the thought appeals to you more, I can certainly share my limited experiences with the local methods."
Nakane waved a hand dismissively, turning to Vorain.
"And you, Thorngard, what can you do?"
"Quite good with a sword, miss, quite good."
The former goddess tapped the hilt of her sword appreciatively.
"Very well.
Nakane turned to Lydia.
I suppose they'll be sufficient for now, but I'd feel more comfortable if you or Aladir remain present as well. My mother has grown accustomed to your presence, and I suspect your departure would make her feel uncomfortable.
Lydia nodded.
I'll make sure at least one of us checks in on you periodically. You can trust these two, however. They're being quite humble about their skills, I assure you. I should hope so. Well, if you're satisfied with the protection these two can provide, what will your next move be?
Lydia reached down, moving her knight forward on a daring charge into enemy lines.
Confronting the assassin, of course.
What precisely do you mean that Alandir Tethereal is unavailable?
Lydia stood outside the grounds of Alandir's manor, only one of several on House Tethereal's grounds within the city. The three guards, Rethri Holmes generally had three guards, she had never learned why, were all offering her apologetic looks with varying degrees of sincerity. The guards were dressed extravagantly, with their blue tunics embroidered with the symbol of a bird, also blue but with green highlights, on a purple shield. They wore green trousers with golden trim, all pristine in quality. Each wore a short sword on their hip, and the two in back carried iron-tipped spears. Lydia knew House Tethereal wasn't the wealthiest house in the city, but she had a hard time believing it looking at their servants, and their perfect gardens, or the marble statues that dotted the grounds of the complex. The sorceress had never had the occasion to visit the few families that reportedly commanded even greater resources. She imagined they would have to line their paths with solid gold to look any more opulent. Aladir wasn't with her, which was probably for the best. His relationship with his father had been strained for years, and even if the two had been on good terms, he couldn't have been expected to be objective in an investigation. That didn't stop her from using Aladir's name to improve her odds of getting quick access to Alandir, of course, but she had been stopped by something far more mundane.
"Forgive me, Dame Hastings. He is not currently in the city."
The guard bowed slightly at the waist, putting his hand over his heart and closing his eyes in a demonstration of sincerity. The title caught her slightly off guard. Sir and Dame were generally considered antiquated titles. Either the man was trained to be extremely formal, or he was simply trying to let her down as lightly as possible. The reason was irrelevant, of course. She needed results, not platitudes.
"Where is he, then?"
She crossed her arms, then uncrossed them quickly, reminding herself not to look as impatient as she was feeling. She didn't realize that she had unconsciously been tapping her foot as well.
"I'm afraid that's not something we're aware of,"
the same guard said. She watched the other guards to see if they had any reactions to his statements, but their expressions were completely taciturn.
"Gods, I wish I had about 10 guards this disciplined to keep an eye on Nakane."
Her request for additional help had been met with the usual reluctance, followed by an assurance that she would be given additional manpower just as soon as possible, which meant never in all likelihood. For the last 3 days, Lydia and Aladir had taken shifts protecting both Nakane and her mother, Nadelia. House Theus had their own guards, but they had proven insufficient once already, and Lydia was convinced that there was still the threat of another attack.
"I just don't have enough information. I need to try to discern the motive, at least."
It had occurred to Lydia that Nakane was a suspect. She was a sorceress, and as the younger child, she had just potentially won an inheritance with the death of her brother. Her behavior was strangely detached, at least by comparison to the obvious grief of her mother. The main reason she doubted Nakane was responsible was that she was almost certain that Edric would be able to determine Nakane's innocence or guilt when he returned to the city. The man's resourcefulness was legendary, and he was almost certain to expend all his efforts in attempting to find his son's killer.
"Which could be why Nakane is so desperate to find someone else to pin this on," Lydia reminded herself. "It's plausible she could feel the brunt of the investigation, or just the blame, if no one else is available to be Edric's target."
"Very well," she said, mirroring the formal tone of the guard. "In that case, I will need access to his home."
The lead guard quirked an eyebrow.
"I am certain we could arrange a tour. May I inquire as to the nature of your business?"
"Aladir and I are in the midst of a criminal investigation, and we had hoped to utilize Alandir as a resource."
"Partially true. The elder Tathiriel's sorceress expertise would be quite useful if he is not the culprit.
In the absence of Eladir's father, I might be able to find something useful in his library. He's known for having an impressive collection, and some of the books may be relevant to our needs.
I see. The lead guard hesitated for a few moments, took a breath, and then turned and waved a hand at one of the other uniformed men. Aloris, please escort the paladin to the library. She is to be given access to any of the books, provided, of course, that she reads them within the library.
He turned back to Lydia.
My apologies, but as much as I would like to, I cannot allow you to remove any of the books without the Lord's permission. Unless, of course, you have a writ—
She waved a hand dismissively.
I'm not putting Eladir under arrest. This should be quite satisfactory. If I need to withdraw anything, I'm sure I can send Eladir to retrieve it.
Yes, of course.
The elder guard gave a strained smile.
If you require nothing else of me...
Guess I wore him out.
You've been very helpful. I'll be off to the library now.
Eladir's library was as extensive as Lydia had suspected, and searching through it in detail would have taken a considerable amount of time. She contented herself to looking for anything overtly suspicious. The sorceress did not expect to find anything as conspicuous as a book on murder, although she did find a rather fanciful novel supposedly written by the Blackstone Assassin. Instead, she hoped to find anything related to the Dominion of Poison. House Tathiriel was famous for their study of healing, both mundane and sorceress, and just finding a book on poison would not have been suspicious in itself. She found several scrolls and a few books detailing mundane poisons, their symptoms, and their treatments. They certainly could have justified having a book on the Dominion of Poison, but she didn't find any. With some hesitation, she eventually asked the librarian if they had any and received a negative in response. Lydia did find multiple books on the Dominion of Travel, one of the necessary prerequisites for the summoning ritual she had discovered. That was, unfortunately, also nothing that could be used as evidence by itself. Travel sorcery was notoriously difficult, but relatively well studied due to the utility that it provided. She had even spent a bit of time studying it herself, but only the theory behind it. She had never actually cast any spells of the kind. During her time in Orlan, her former friend Verudin had been a practitioner of travel sorcery. He had explained that it was relatively easy to use travel sorcery to enhance your own movement, and much more challenging to use it for its most famous applications, teleportation and summoning. Teleportation could be used to move from one place to another in an instant. From what Lydia understood about the theory, the spell was actually moving the target into the plane of travel, then to another point on the plane of travel that corresponded to your destination, and then back out into the core plane. Distances on the plane of travel differed from distances on the core plane, but she was not aware of any published equation with a conversion ratio. Instead, it was more popularly accepted that locations were linked between the planes through concentrations of energy rather than distance. There were two main limiting factors on teleportation: conceptualization and strain. The first meant that the caster needed to have a clear concept of the destination for their spell to function. Typically, this involved having visited the location before. The easiest form of teleportation was to go somewhere else that was currently in sight, since conceptualizing the movement between those locations was simple. Travel sorcerers often used objects or locations infused with travel sorcery as beacons for teleporting long distances. Lydia knew that Verudin had concealed jars of Dominion essence in several locations in the Low Palace to have convenient locations to teleport to, but she found the idea terrifying. Anyone who knew about the jars could have moved them, changing the destination of Verudin's teleportation spells. The second limitation, strain, was comparatively simple. The further you traveled with a single spell, the more strain the teleportation put on the body. The amount was not directly equivalent to the amount of stress on the body from physically walking the entire distance, but it was considered conventional wisdom that teleporting more than a day's walk was unwise. Physical conditioning helped to tolerate teleportation strain. An experienced long-distance runner could teleport long distances much more easily than someone without similar conditioning. Similarly, children and the elderly suffered more from teleportation strain. Interestingly, travel sorcery could be used to cross planar boundaries without exponentially greater strain. Most sorcerers believed that this meant that the planes were not physically distant from one another, but somehow overlapped. The analogy that Lydia had heard was that two planes were like two pieces of parchment in a stack. When standing atop the top piece of paper, the bottom piece is invisible, even though it is a minute distance away. If she wanted to reach the other piece of paper, she did not have to traverse the entire length of the paper to get to the next. She merely needed to find a path through the top paper to the bottom page. That analogy made traveling to other planes sound simple, but while studying the sorcery books, Lydia realized there were several problems with it. First, the conceptualization limitation. Someone who had never been to another plane had no destination to focus on. Without a familiar location, moving to another plane meant going to either a place at random or whatever spot on the other plane was closest to where the caster was currently located. In either case, the destination was very probable to be unsafe. Any given plane was primarily constructed from its namesake dominion, although every plane would have some energy and materials from other adjacent planes. Traveling to the plane of water in a random location meant that you were probably going to appear underwater. Even a sorcerer prepared with spells for breathing underwater might not be safe, however, since the water could be in any possible state, depending on where the sorcerer ended up. The travel sorcerer could appear inside a block of ice larger than a planet, or in a similar-sized cloud of water vapor. And water was one of the safest planes. Many of the others offered instant death for an unprepared visitor. Thus, sorcerers typically used other forms of sorcery, such as knowledge and sight sorcery, to scout out possible destinations on other planes well in advance. Existing research could be helpful, but most sorcerers would take the time to verify it to the best of their own ability. From there, the sorcerer would have to research any of the necessary forms of protection to survive on the other plane. Since having access to more than two or three types of sorcery was rare, that typically meant a single sorcerer could not do all of the research, preparations for survival, and teleportation all on their own. The books that Lydia found were similar to ones that she had read in the past, mostly containing theory and the application of basic spells. Summoning was advanced enough that she only found a single paragraph on the subject.
In 2884, a group of Thorngard experimented with the concept of using a reverse teleportation spell, referred to as a summoning spell in modern nomenclature, for the purpose of bringing a native creature from another plane to the core plane. The project garnered the attention and subsequent sponsorship of one of the Vaykess, whom provided the resources necessary for dozens of attempts. After over 100 trials, only a single entity was successfully summoned, a creature that resembled one of the Asharin, but with green and brown skin and deer-like horns. The creature reportedly survived the teleportation process, but details are scarce. The project was abandoned shortly thereafter, and all participants sworn to secrecy.
In the more than 200 years since the date cited in the book, the study of summoning had advanced significantly. But the paragraph did help to reinforce how difficult and expensive the process was. That only helped to reinforce Lydia's belief that this murder could not have been committed without a strong motive. The cost and level of difficulty was simply too high. More importantly, the story reminded Lydia that there were many distinct types of life on other planes. Comparatively simple creatures like fragments, gatherers, and harvesters were well documented, but every plane had their own types of unique forms of life, and even communicating with the best-known types of extraplanar creatures was difficult. Convincing such an entity to go to the core plane to kill someone seemed like more trouble than it was worth.
Is that even what happened, then? I've been assuming that someone summoned something like a harvester of poison and sent it to kill Nakane's brother. But what other options are there?
She bit her lower lip, considering what other possibilities she could think of.
Maybe the sorcerer has some kind of home on the plane of poison. Rather than summoning a creature from there, he or she simply teleported from the plane of poison to the core plane, committed the murder, and then returned to that home. Creating a safe location on another plane would be difficult, especially on a plane like that, but not impossible. That ritual we found definitely did look like a summoning ritual, though. Someone could have set it up deliberately to look like a summoning ritual had been used as a form of deflection from their actual methodology, but that's a little unlikely. But we assumed the exit portal was leading to the same place as the entity was initially summoned from. The sorcerer could have summoned the assassin from anywhere and then placed the Dominion essence of poison in the circle afterward, making the destination different from where it initially came from. Given how strong of a connection to the Dominion of Poison the creature had, however, a native to that plane, or something attuned to it, would still be the most likely case. An Asharan, or another creature that is capable of adapting to Dominion energy, could have survived being exposed to powerful poison and taken on an aura like that. Another option to consider, but even more complex than summoning something native to that plane.
Lydia flipped through another several books before coming to the frustrating realization that she was broadening the possibilities of how the crime had occurred, not narrowing down the culprit. While the information she had gathered would be useful for eliminating subjects that lacked the resources to succeed at the rituals she had witnessed, she needed more definitive evidence to know who to focus her investigation on. For that, she was going to need a bit more help. She offered her sincere gratitude to the librarian and the guards, and then left to meet with one of the most dangerous men in the world. The town of Edge Lake was more commonly referred to simply as Hartigan, the surname of the local ruler. It took 2 days of riding for Lydia to reach the town, but it would have been remiss of her to dismiss Nakane's first suspect simply because of the distance. As the Theus daughter had pointed out, Blake Hartigan was one of the few who had the necessary wealth and power to arrange to be teleported back and forth from the city.
Although, Lydia considered, the city's walls are supposed to prevent teleporting directly into the city from outside. Wouldn't that apply to summoning an entity from another plane?
She frowned at the incongruity and decided that she'd have to investigate the wards to determine exactly how they functioned. Several possibilities occurred to her immediately, but the most concerning was that the summoner might have been powerful enough to bypass the wards with brute power. It was an unlikely possibility, but disconcerting, to say the least. It was more likely that the protection simply did not apply to spells that originated from within the city, which the summoning spell would have, or that something had been built into the defenses to allow them to be bypassed through specific means. While she didn't find it likely that Hartigan was the culprit, she was well prepared for a possible confrontation. She wore a saber on her left hip and a dagger on her right, the latter balanced for throwing rather than parrying. The sorceress was also wearing Adon's ring, and though she hadn't been able to activate it yet, she had some ideas on how to force it to function in an emergency situation. Finally, she had surrounded herself with a comprehensive barrier spell, her own personal invention, and practically a second skin during any operation that she considered dangerous. The spell utilized the Dominion of Protection to block attacks, while simultaneously using a key from the Dominion of Knowledge to identify any offensive spells that struck the barrier. The combination allowed her to make tactical decisions on how to counter the abilities of enemy sorcerers, although she had a pretty good idea of what she'd be facing if she antagonized Hartigan. His reputation for incinerating dozens of enemies at a time had earned him the moniker the Ember Lord. The paladin wasn't exactly sure how she'd approach Hartigan, even after 2 days to think about it. The man was a notorious recluse, even more so than most sorcerers. At least finding him would not be difficult. His residence was a colossal stone tower standing vigilant over the comparatively minuscule homes of the town's other residents. The tower itself made sense to Lydia. After all, the vast majority of spells were easier to cast with the target within sight, and the top of a tower was a fantastic vantage point. Hartigan's habits were strange even by the standards of sorcerers, however. Rumors indicated that he spent months isolated in his tower, only to emerge to purchase, or requisition, broad varieties of strange goods from the townsfolk. She had heard stories of the sorcerer levitating a dozen live goats onto the top of his tower before thanking the previous owners and returning to his work. While stabling her horse at the local inn, Lydia asked a few questions of the other patrons, learning that Hartigan was well-liked in spite of his odd habits.
He would respond quickly if the village faced any large problems, and often gave generous gifts with seemingly no concern for their value. And while he had a reputation for being fiercely dangerous, he had apparently never turned his dangerous powers against any of his own people. In fact, they felt safer when he was around. There didn't appear to be any particular customs for greeting the local lord. While she absently considered bringing some live goats, Lydia settled for simply knocking on the tower's wooden doors.
"I wonder if he can even hear me if he's all the way up there,"
Lydia considered, looking upward at the dozen or more floors of the tower looming above her.
"Maybe if he marked the door with sound sorcery of some kind to project the noise from knocking..."
The door opened. Beyond the door stood a woman that looked to be in her 40s, folding her arms over a lightly stained apron.
"What you want, girl?"
Lydia blinked.
"I'm, looking for Lord Hardigan."
"Course you are. Ain't got anyone looking that fancy come calling for me.
What you here for?"
Lydia didn't think her travel-worn outfit looked all that fancy, even with her paladins of Teos Tabard worn over it, but clearly this woman had different standards.
"I'm Lydia Hastings, with the Paladins of Teos. I'd like to speak to the Lord as part of an investigation."
The older woman sighed, turning around and facing toward a spiral stairway within the tower.
"Blake! There's a paladin here to see you!"
The older woman turned back around, rubbing her hands on the apron.
"Guess you'd better come on in, then."
"Thank you, Miss
Hardigan, dear. Sarah Hardigan."
She waved a hand, beckoning for Lydia to come in. The paladin took the cue, stepping inside, and Sarah closed the door behind them.
"You must be Lord Hardigan's granddaughter?"
The older woman made a scoffing noise.
"You're too kind, dear. I'm his wife. Spare him the judgments for marrying a woman a century his junior. Once you get past around 30, the years mean less and less."
Lydia nodded uncertainly, doing her best not to show her embarrassment. A man descended the spiral stairway nearby a few moments later, and Lydia raised her head to examine him. A few strands of brown were still visible amongst his graying hair, and his face was deeply lined with the wrinkles of many years of mirth. He was barefoot, wearing plain trousers and a simple linen tunic. The only obvious signs of his wealth were the half-dozen rings on his hands. His age seemed similarly concealed. He walked with a straight back and without the assistance of a cane. If she had not heard Sarah call for Blake, she would have guessed she was seeing someone else entirely. A man in his 50s, perhaps, rather than a sorcerer of over 100. She hadn't been certain what a man who had preserved his own life through sorcery would look like, but she hadn't expected the answer to be completely normal.
"What's all this about, hm?"
The man finally seemed to notice Lydia when he reached the bottom of the steps.
"Oh, we have a guest. How can I help you, young lady?"
Lydia glanced at Sarah, who seemed to be watching her expectantly.
"Well, this is awkward. I'd rather talk to him alone, but I can hardly dismiss the woman in her own home." "Well, I suppose I should start by introducing myself. I'm Lydia Hastings, a major for the Paladins of Teos."
She didn't typically like to open a conversation with her rank, but when dealing with nobles, it often served to help them take her more seriously. This was especially true when dealing with the older nobles, who didn't tend to give female paladins much respect.
"Been a while since I've had a visit from a paladin. Blake Hardigan."
He approached and extended a hand cordially, and she returned the gesture by clasping his wrist. The sorcerer froze for a moment as she did so, and as she pulled her hand away, he raised his own hand to his chin.
"That ring you're wearing. Are you one of Donovan's students?"
"Oh, resh. Hardigan practically invented the process of enchanting rings. Of course he recognizes it. Better be honest. He'll probably figure it out eventually one way or another."
Lydia shook her head.
"No, I'm afraid not."
"How'd you come by that ring, then?"
He shook his head.
"You'll have to forgive me. I've been terribly rude. Please, come, sit with me."
He turned around without another word, waving a hand for her to follow.
"I suppose I'll go make some tea,"
Sarah said, rolling her eyes.
"Thank you, Miss Hardigan,"
Lydia said.
"Sorry to trouble you.
Oh, you're fine, dear. The older woman disappeared into a smaller room on the left, humming to herself. Blake Hardigan led Lydia up the spiral stairway, passing a single door before stopping at the next and waving his hand across a sigil above the doorknob. The sigil flickered and vanished, leading Lydia to quirk an eyebrow.
Most ritual protections require a more complex action for deactivation. How did it detect his wave? Something with the dominion of sight, perhaps? Or maybe it isn't actually seeing him. The ward could be triggered by proximity to him, or to one of the rings. It's probably one of the rings.
He turned the knob, leading Lydia into a sitting room. A single table sat in the center, littered with books and surrounded by plush chairs. A footstool accompanied each chair, an accoutrement that Lydia could appreciate. Tall bookshelves lined the walls, housing an impressive collection of tomes, scrolls, and what looked like vials of liquid on one of the shelves. A single window, sealed with heavy bars, let in light from the outside. Hardigan patted the back of one of the chairs.
"Please, sit."
He moved on to sit in the opposite chair. Lydia dutifully followed his instructions. While she was still nervous that he could react poorly to an explanation about how she had obtained the ring, or about why she was there, she didn't see any reason to be discourteous. Also, the chair was pretty comfortable.
"So,"
Hardigan began, propping up his feet on the stool next to his chair.
"You've got quite an interesting object there, Miss Scryer."
Lydia noted that he had used the name Scryer, which was not the name she had given him. Scryer was the name she had used when she had attended the Sorcery Academy in Velthrin. It was her adoptive father's surname. It was, notably, also the surname she had used in Orlan when she had been investigating the local gods, one of whom was Donovan, the man Hardigan had mentioned.
"Okay, so he knows something about who I am, and he wants me to know that. Interesting, but not necessarily a threat. Not yet, anyway. He might just have heard my name sometime at the academy. He did teach classes there, even if I never took any of them."
"Yes, thank you. You have some exceptionally fine rings yourself. Is one of those the legendary Hardigan Star? I've always wanted to see it." The older man leaned his chin into the knuckles of his left hand, smirking slightly.
"No, these are lesser trinkets, I'm afraid. Perhaps I can show you the ring later. Is that why you're here?"
She shook her head.
"No, I'm afraid I have some official business to discuss."
Hardigan nodded, leaning back.
"I suspected as much. Indulge my curiosity, however. How did you come upon Donovan's ring?"
"Well, nothing to do but gamble at this point, one way or another.
Several months ago, Donovan Taylor was masquerading as a god in the city of Orlan. I was involved in his arrest, and confiscated this ring in the process." Hardigan chuckled, lightly shaking his head.
"That boy. Too smart for his own good. I knew he'd get himself into trouble. I hoped the ring might help keep him out of it. But that was too much to hope for, I suppose."
Lydia wasn't sure what to say next, so she remained silent and as still as possible.
"Pretending to be a god. Such ridiculousness. He always had delusions of grandeur, but I had hoped I had taught him to have the sense not to act on them. He was an idealist, though. Still is, I imagine, if he's alive. Did you kill him?"
The sorceress shook her head.
"No, I assisted in his arrest, and he was turned into the queen for a trial. As far as I'm aware, he was not executed."
"How were you able to apprehend him? Donovan was no amateur sorcerer, and one of the most paranoid men I've ever met."
Lydia tensed her jaw, not sure how much to say.
"I investigated his capabilities to the best of my ability. When an opportunity presented itself, I incapacitated him using sorcery. I also had help."
Hardigan scratched at his chin.
"Interesting. Incapacitated him how? He was fairly good at protection sorcery, if I recall."
"He's trying to gauge my abilities," she realized, "which could mean he's planning for a fight. It could just be honest curiosity, I suppose. Sorcerers do tend to love hearing about fights between other sorcerers. Still, I should be careful what I say. One of my allies was able to disable Donovan's barrier, From there, I knocked him out with a simple sleep spell. After intercepting an attack on Talion, hitting Donovan's barrier repeatedly, faking my death when I was enveloped by one of Donovan's spells, and enhancing one of Jonin's illusions with a protective barrier to make it appear to be corporeal. But Hartigan doesn't need to know about those little details.
A sleep spell?
Hartigan covered his mouth, laughing deeply into it.
That has to be the most ignominious way a deity, fake or not, has ever been defeated.
The man made a circular gesture with his hand, taking a tiny bow at the waist.
And you managed to walk off with his ring. Confiscated for the paladins of Taos or some such, I imagine. You have my commendations, miss.
The sorceress wasn't quite sure, but she was fairly confident she was blushing.
Thank you, sir.
You wouldn't happen to know what happened after you...
He snorted. Put Donovan to sleep, would you?
Lydia shrugged at that.
I don't know much, to be honest. I doubt he'd be executed. He was the leader of the local gods for years, after all. That might make too much of an uproar. As far as I'm aware, he's still imprisoned.
Imprisonment may be a harsher fate for a man such as him. I doubt he'll ever stop searching for ways to escape. But never mind that.
He lifted a hand, pointing it at the ring.
I made that, you know. And no, that isn't Hartigan's star either, if you were wondering.
He smiled softly.
It was an earlier version. The 17th of them. I scrapped most of them, using the materials for the next copy. But a few I gave to especially promising apprentices, such as Donovan.
Lydia quirked a brow, genuinely surprised.
Donovan was your apprentice? I never read anything about that in his files.
No, just like no one will read about this visit in your file, unless you choose to tell them about it.
She saw a hint of mirth in the older man's eye.
Most people who come to me for training do so discreetly. Especially paladins and priests. I have a bit of a reputation, you see.
Lydia let herself chuckle at that remark, while playing over the implications in her head.
So he's trained paladins and priests before. How many aside from Donovan? And what does he teach them? Is he how Donovan learned how to extend his life?
That was a loose end she had never completely tied up. She had figured out how Donovan was making his miracles and imbuing others with sorcery, but the man had also appeared too young for his physical age, much like Hartigan himself did. Powerful sorcerers like Edric Theus and Blake Hartigan were so notoriously secretive that she had assumed that Donovan had found a new method.
And Jonin hypothesized that Donovan was extending his life through sacrificing the Rethri,
she recalled.
But we determined that he wasn't doing that. He was experimenting with Rethri Dominion bonds, and I never investigated Donovan's agelessness afterward. It just didn't seem important once we had the details of how he was doing everything else. Interesting.
Are you implying that you'd be willing to train me?
Lydia asked, intrigued in spite of herself. This wasn't what she was there for, and her professional instincts were inwardly kicking her, but she had to ask.
I'd be willing to entertain the possibility. I could use an assistant around the lab, and good help is hard to come by. But I've already delayed your own inquiries quite enough. I've been quite rude. Forgive me. If you're here on paladin business, please tell me what it pertains to.
Resh, he was good.
She already hadn't wanted to antagonize him, since he was tremendously dangerous. Now she also wanted to stay on his good side, so she could try to take advantage of the possibility of training under him. If anyone knew how to figure out how to make the ring work, it would be the man who made it. And Hartigan undoubtedly had far greater secrets, like immortality, for example. His manipulations were impressive, but loyalty, unfortunately, came first.
I'm here as part of a murder investigation. Calceris Theus was killed 6 days ago. You are one of the possible suspects.
Hartigan's expression darkened immediately.
Kay was murdered? The poor boy. His father must be crushed. How did this happen?
Lydia sat up in her chair.
Hartigan's use of the nickname Kay certainly implies he knew the victim, and he didn't even address the fact that I just mentioned he was a suspect.
I'm afraid I can't give you too many details,
until I've ruled you out as a possible suspect. I apologize. I can say honestly that I find it unlikely that you are responsible, given your remote location, but...
But I have a well-documented rivalry with Edric, yes, of course. When two men know each other for over 100 years, there are bound to be conflicts of interest from time to time. I assure you that my disagreements with Edric were, and still are, philosophical and academic in nature. I would never commit violence toward him, and certainly not to his family.
Lydia nodded. Where were you on the evening of the 7th round? No, let's just say the whole evening.
The man shrugged his shoulders. I don't keep that close of track. I mean, I was here, that much is certain. I haven't been out of the tower in a month. I don't remember specifics. I could go check my alchemical notes, I suppose.
Alchemical notes?
As I'm sure you're aware, I make potions, salves, and elixirs of all sorts, many of them requiring adding ingredients at specific intervals. After singeing off my eyebrows the first few times, I learned to take extensive notes.
I would be interested in seeing those notes. If they include anything that occurred during the time of the attack, that could be some slim evidence in your favor, although obviously such notes could be easily faked if you had committed the attack and planned on being investigated.
Hardigan nodded. Yes, of course. I'll retrieve the notes. Please, wait here.
He stood up and retreated from the room. Lydia absently felt for the comforting presence of her barrier spell, which remained intact. If he's going to try to kill me, now would probably be the time to do it. The sorceress sat facing the doorway, glancing from side to side periodically and keeping her hand near the hilt of her saber. She resisted the urge to search the room while Hardigan was absent. It would be somewhat rude if he wasn't intending to murder her. The older man returned a few minutes later with a thick stack of parchment, setting it down on the table a moment later.
You'll have to forgive me. I just grabbed a whole section. I haven't had a chance to parse through it and find the knight you spoke of yet. If you wouldn't mind...
I'll take half the stack, she offered with only a slight grimace, taking his cue. Parsing through the notes was dull work. They were exhaustive, just as he had claimed, but not in any obvious order. Usually, two or three adjacent pages corresponded to the same date, but papers didn't always sit next to the ones from the next date. By the time she found the night of the attack, she suspected that he organized the papers based on the components used in the potions, presumably so he could keep track of any unusual results or his current stocks of each.
I found something, she noted, slipping out a few pieces from the pile.
There were, in fact, notes that seemed to cover the entire evening of Calcirus's death, but with at least two notable gaps of a few hours.
It looks like you were not working on any potions for about 3 hours here, she noted.
Hardly enough time to travel to Velthrin, wouldn't you say?
The older man set down his stack of papers, shrugging.
I was probably having dinner.
It could be enough time if you teleported, Lydia pointed out.
Ah, was teleportation involved in the crime?
Hardigan scratched at his chin.
Still prying for more information.
It might have been. I assume your wife would vouch for your presence, but frankly, that doesn't amount to much either.
Well, it's dreadfully hard to prove a negative, as I'm sure you know. What would you need to rule out my involvement?
What indeed?
It was an excellent question. She hadn't been directly involved in a murder investigation before. Her research on Donovan was probably the most similar situation, although she had also traced smaller crimes back to specific sorcerers in the past. She had a spell for identifying which specific dominions a sorcerer had access to, and that was typically quite useful, especially for finding obscure dominions. She had considered using the same methodology for this case, but most of the spells she could cast on Hardigan wouldn't provide any sort of certainty, since he was famous for utilizing enhanced items and potions. Even if he wasn't personally capable of casting travel or poison sorcery, he could have an item, or even an apprentice, since apparently he had those, capable of casting the spell.
It would be difficult to prove your innocence definitively without evidence you were here at the time of the crime. At the moment, I'm more interested in finding evidence that could potentially indicate that you are the killer, and in the absence of that, I can move on to look into other culprits.
Very well, Hardigan clapped his hands together. I will give you full access to the tower for your investigation. I'll be interested to see your process, in fact.
The latter sentence added,